I'd like to start just by giving a very brief and very selective history of some relevant parts of quantum photonics. So I think here on the left-hand side, so work has gone along two tracks, basically. So here on the left-hand side, we have proofs, or rigorous proof of the existence of photonics, quantum noise thresholds. And on the right-hand side, we have estimates and simulations. And so, in a sense, after these initial first breakthroughs by Harnden and Benoit and Kayat, the theory has been playing catch-up with the heuristic threshold estimates. And so, for example, Steen and also many others, many of these people, worked with a concatenated distance 3 drilling to simulate their photonic schemes. But in fact, it wasn't known until very recently that there even existed a photonic threshold for such codes. Although it was widely assumed. So in 2004-2005, Henning Knill developed a rather novel photonic scheme, which brought together a number of new ideas. But the most important one of those ideas for this talk will be that of error detection or post-selection. So when an error is detected, he rejects and he starts over instead of trying to correct the errors. And so by using this kind of scheme, he's able to estimate significantly higher noise thresholds, perhaps as high as 3 to 6%, nearly an order of magnitude higher than previous photonic schemes, their estimates. Needless to say, relying on error detection instead of error correction leads to higher overhead. So here's a plot taken from one of his papers. And so to read it, you fix your noise rate down here, so say 10 minus 4. And then you decide how large a computation you want to run. So say, with between 10 to the 8 and 10 to the 13, ideal gates, I can certainly factor some rather large numbers. That's an interesting area to be. And so then you look over here, and it says the overhead per gate is around 10 to the 3, perhaps to 10 to the 5. And so the overhead at low noise rates isn't too unreasonable, perhaps. But you can see it blows up extremely quickly when you move over to the 1% noise per gate range. So, I guess once more, none of these previous proofs applied to Knill's photonic scheme. I'll explain why in a moment. And so what I'll explain today is a proof of the existence of some positive threshold for schemes like Mannich-Knill's. And here are just a few of the results. So I'm able to prove the existence of positive noise rates for schemes based on error detecting codes. In addition, the technique used to prove the existence is also efficient enough to apply numerically. And I'm able to show that in a certain quite artificial noise model, even 1% noise per gate can be tolerated. This is an extremely artificial noise model. In a more standard depolarization noise model, I'm able to show 10 minus 3 noise per gate being tolerated. Now, before going into the details of the proof, I'd like just to explain the simple idea behind it. So it's actually just basically grade school algebra. The idea is mixing probability distributions. So here we have two events, A and B. And you see they're not quite independent. There's a slight positive correlation. It's not 4p squared, it's 5p squared. But you can rewrite this point as a mixture between these two distributions, in which the events A and B are exactly independent. So rewriting distributions, which have complicated correlations, which are quite messy, as mixtures of very simple distributions, probability distributions, is the main technique I'm going to use. And that's just another example. So I'll start by going over the intuition behind the proof and to give us something concrete to talk about, and also because it's perhaps the most interesting gate. Let's talk about the control knot gate. And for now, at least, just a classical noise model will suffice to get across the ideas. So let's assume that every time we try to apply a control knot gate, what we actually apply is a perfect control knot gate followed by a noise location. So all these noise locations, they're independent of each other. They have three parameters, P, XI, IX, and PXX. which are the probabilities for flipping the first bit, flipping the second bit, or flipping both. And the condition is that their sum is the most p. Now, to work around this noise, we pick a classical error correcting code, and we compute on top of the error correcting code, as everyone knows. And in what sense does this improve things? One could say, for example, that this control knock gadget has better reliability than the physical control knock gate, in the sense that this diagram commutes with good probability. And so I say applying the gadget and decoding the outputs has the same effect as decoding the inputs and then applying a perfect gate. Now, because we have a distance 3 code, this diagram will indeed commute, provided at most one error occurs in this whole block. So here I plotted the probability of this diagram failing to commute. It's CP squared, which is P. And the thing to notice is that there's some threshold beneath which things get better. We have an improvement. And so to get arbitrary improvement, we just we'll repeat the scheme over and over again. That's the intuition. But this intuition is not very well founded, actually. And the reason is because encoded gates are much more complicated than single gates. It's not enough, for example, you know, this is a gate on 6 qubits, this is just a gate on 2. It's not enough to describe this whole thing just by one parameter, by the rate of this diagram fails to commute. And so, really, I think the problem that comes up when you're trying to improve photonic thresholds is how do you analyze these much more complicated gates than many other qubits. And also, I guess, for example, nice parameters of the base noise model aren't preserved when you move to here. So, for example, I assume that each of these gates fails independently of each other. But it will not be the case that these modules fail independently of each other, in the sense of this diagram not commuting. So, for example, if one of these fails, then there'll be a bunch of errors here, and then the next gate will be much more likely to fail too, possibly. And so the idea between error detection is that we replace each of these error correction blocks with an error detection block. And this improves things. But because before it was quadratic that this diagram failed to commute, now, conditioned on not detecting any errors, it'll be cubic probability that this fails to commute. And so that pushes the break-even point higher, roughly. And I think that's all this says. Now, despite Phil's estimates that this kind of scheme tolerated noise between 3 and 6%, as I said, there's been no proof that it tolerated any positive noise rate. So here's one picture trying to explain why that might be the case. And so I guess previous schemes worked by trying to control most of the computer most of the time. So occasionally there's a bad effect, like for example that diagram not commuting. And when that happens, you have to assume worst case behavior. So part of the computer falls out of control, say 1% probability. Now when you do error detection, you run into problems because it's quite unlikely that the block will survive error detection, a large block. Most of the time there will be errors. And so perhaps only 1 in 99 fraction survives. But now this is worst case, we have to assume it all survives, and that's 1%. Now you condition on that event that no errors are detected. So in other words, you renormalize this distribution and you all the way blown up to 50% from control. So maybe intuitively this problem shouldn't happen. I mean, intuitively, this portion of the computer should be really bad, should be really ugly, because we haven't been able to analyze it. But the fact that we haven't been able to analyze it means that we can't put upper bounds or lower bounds on the noise rate. In particular, it could be the case that this is perfect. It doesn't have any noise at all. And in that case, it will survive error detection with higher probability than the controlled portion of the system survives. And so after you renormalize, after you condition on not detecting errors, the uncontrolled portion of the system explodes. And so I'll just sketch the proof. Here's a picture for this noise model, the bit flip matrix, which is what I'll consider to start. The simplest error detecting code is just a 2-bit representation code, so let's just work with that. So here are the control, and here's the transversal control not gate, and here's an error detection module. So I prepare an ancilla in 0, I check the parity of these two bits, and I condition on saying 0. So I condition on these two being the same. Now we need just one piece of notation for the proof to go through easily. Let's define a noisy encoder. It takes one bit as input, it outputs 2 bits. So it takes one bit into a code block. And it's a perfect encoder followed by noise, followed by bitwise independent noise at rates upper bounded by p. And so the kind of claim we'd like to prove is something like this. So we'd like to say, if coming into our control not gadget, we have bitwise independent noise, then we can commute this through. So we can say that has the same effect as a perfect control not gate, followed by encoding and then have bitwise independent noise on the outputs. That's a big extreme thing if we prove this, because then we'd be able to go through the whole analysis. So we start with bitwise independent noise. Here are these bold lines that are supposed to represent code blocks. These are encoded control not gates. Then we apply this rule repeatedly. We just pull these encoders past one by one. What we end up with is a perfect circuit with bitwise independent noise on unencoded outputs at the end, if this were true. But of course, it's not true. I mean, one way you can see that is, for example, both of these control not gates could fail, which is a probability p squared of them. And that could corrupt the output of the entire of both blocks. Yeah. And so an XXXX error is probably p squared on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, it's supposed to be with bitwise independent noise. That should be probably p or b before. So there's just no way these can be equal. But that's easy to fix. We can just add another independent noise location here. So now I'm saying, if we have bitwise independent noise coming into the gadget, then the output has bitwise independent noise on a perfect control not gate, plus quadratically suppressed the possibility of an encoded or logical error. But this is also independent of all the other noise locations. This is actually just about equally nice as the previous state, because again, we can pull these noisy encoders through the encoded circuit in our analysis. And we see that this is what you're left with. You're left with perfect control not gates followed by independent noise at rates order p squared. And in particular, the noise model is exactly preserved. So we started with independent noise. We still have independent noise. It's just much smaller. So we can repeat this procedure over and over again because the noise model is preserved. And the picture that I drew before would be exactly accurate. But again, this is that statement wasn't true. That meta quality at the top. And why isn't it true? It's just the world's not that nice. We have whatever is coming out of here, it's going to have lots of correlations. It's not likely to be able to describe it with just a few parameters. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different noise locations. So it's basically 5 parameters. Well, I guess you get different kinds of noise. But over here you have 1, 2, 2 to the 4, 16 parameters. You're not going to be able to match this distribution generically with the distribution of this form. It is the case, though, that the left-hand side is close to the right. It's like just delta far away. And so here I change this to equality, the plus delta. But now this is exactly the situation I sketched up before. So this plus delta, I know absolutely nothing about it. I have no bounds on the errors in there. No idea whether, it's extremely noisy or not noisy at all. So after the next round of error detection, I have to assume that delta blows up exponentially. And so we've lost any hope of proof if we have that delta there. But certainly in a very artificial noise model, this is OK. And so, for example, if we knew exactly what the noise model is, so if we knew that every controller mod gate filled with probability exactly 1%, then we can prove the threshold quite simply. So what we can do is, we know that every gate fills with 1%, and say we know what the input distribution is, then we know exactly what the output error distribution is, with no error whatsoever. And so what we can do is we can deliberately introduce errors into the calculation, and into the state, so that it satisfies these strong independence constraints. And the way you introduce noise is by just changing the polyframe. But I don't want to go into this too much because it's obviously artificial that you know what the noise model is. But one can show, this is where you get these results of 1% polyphonic noise, right? And that's sort of nice just because you get such a simple proof. But let's try to get something more realistic. Let's move on. Turns out, and this is the main claim, that the true distribution output on the left-hand side, which is all sorts of correlations, it can be rewritten as a mixture of distributions, each of which satisfies these constraints on the right-hand side. So the errors are independent, and they're upper bounded by p or quarter p squared here. And so here's sort of a rough picture. So the true distribution, that's this side, which lies in 16 dimensions. It's close to a bunch of distributions which satisfy these constraints, and in fact, it lies inside their convex hull. Now, this is good enough. Again, it's slightly weaker, but it's still good enough for our analysis to go through. The reason is, at every time step, what we do is we pick one of the nice distributions which satisfies the constraints. Let's pick whichever one we want, and then we continue the analysis on. So we have independent errors, and so we can move on to the next gate, and again we'll be able to pick from the mixture and choose one of these, and then move on to the next gate, and again, keep on going. And so for this to work, we only need to prove this equality, and then the analysis can be repeated indefinitely. And there are basically two ways of proving this. First of all, there's just to prove the existence of some constant polyphonic noise threshold, we need a fairly general argument which works not depending on the particular properties of the noise. It works even if you don't know much about what's going on the left-hand side there. And this argument will work in two steps. First, we'll characterize some convex hull. Then we'll have to, it's a little complicated. Then we'll have to pull this distribution back so we can understand its position inside this convex hull. So let me go into a few more details that's impossible to understand. And the easiest way is to start with an example. So let's just look at two bits. Okay, so these four bits, if there's no error, they are on the first bit, on the second bit, or on both. And the distribution on these four bits has independence if the events are independent, if this probability times this probability is the probability of, if probability of the error on the first bit times the probability of the error on the second bit is that of an error on both bits. And one can show then very easily, fairly straightforwardly, it's an exercise, that the convex hull of all bitwise independent distributions with bit error rates upper bounded by p is given by this picture. And so it's a three-dimensional picture because there's four different terms, but they have to sum up to one. And the extremal points are either it's perfect, there are no errors at all, either both bits fail at rate p, here the first bit fails at rate p, and the second bit is perfect, and here's the other way around. And so now we have to generalize this. So just a couple of remarks on nice things which are happening here. Is first of all, these kinds of coordinates are sort of like lattice coordinates. So it's not, the natural variables are not the probability of xi, it's the probability of xi or xx. So now let's generalize this. And just as this was sort of a lattice, let's look at the hybrid cube lattice. So identify I with 0 and x with 1. And we say that a string x is above a string y if it looks like this. If y is the same, except it could possibly have more ones. So this is the key value. And then the simple generalization of this claim is that the convex hull of all product distributions, in which the ith bit error is opposed to pi, is the set of distributions satisfying these constraints. So it's a simplex, just like here. It lives in 2 to the n minus 1 dimensions. So 2 to the n different events. It has 2 to the n external points. And the external points will be the analogs of these external points. And it has 2 to the n faces. And this is the equation for the face. It doesn't matter too much. It's just what it is. That's like these four faces.
Oh, excuse me?
Yes.
Should the bitwise independence should you have product where you have p of x times x, should you have a factor p times p of I times I?
Wait.
Second bullet on the left hand side of your slide.
Here.
Yeah.
What's
going on? So you have a probability of I times I on the right hand side of this equality?
I'm saying the probability of the event x.
Yeah, x on qubit 1, x on qubit 2 independent.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, you just thought you needed something else on the right hand side, but. Never mind.
I don't know. I've written that down wrong before. I think it's right. Yes. And one can generalize this. Oh, okay. So here it is. So here's a simple example of what these equations look like. So for example, let's fix all the error rates pi to be the same. And then one of these equations for x would look like this. It'll be the probability of all z lying below x down here, divided by p to the weight of x, minus something divided by p to the x plus 1, plus minus something plus. And then it's a simple corollary, which you can see from the form of this equation, that if the probability of a weight x error is order p is the weight of x for every possible error, then this distribution lies in the convex hull of product distributions of error rates order p. It just follows from looking at this equation. And of course it generalizes. Here's a generalized statement. Now standard photon techniques basically suffice to achieve this kind of job. So techniques like recursive purification or repeated syndrome extraction. However, a problem which comes up is that this mixing lemma applies to either 0, 1 to the n, if we're talking only about bitwise errors, or perhaps I, X, Y, Z to the n, if we're talking about general poly errors. Whereas the actual distribution we have is going to live, some errors are going to be equivalent to each other if they're in the stabilizer. So the actual distribution we have lives in this space. So let's call that omega 2, this omega 1. Our solution is going to be we define a function which maps from here to here. And the simplest function, it doesn't really matter. The simplest one is that which maps an error or a string, poly string, down to its error equivalence class. Now this function induces a map on error distribution in the only straightforward way. And it takes bitwise independent distributions here to, it takes product bitwise independent distributions here, of course. And so what we do now is we take our true distribution, so call that pi, and that lives on omega 1. We choose some row, which is in its pre-image of your graph. Choose it however you like. For example, we can divide the probability mass on an error equivalence class evenly among all poly strings which have minimum weight for that error class. And now we apply the mixing limit to this row. And so if it turns out the mixing limit tells us that rho lies in the convex hull of the rho sub I, the nice distributions, that implies, just by linearity, that the actual distribution pi lies in the convex hull of the images of these rho I. So it's this two-step process. We take our distribution, we pull which lives on equivalence classes, we pull it back to poly strings, and then we apply the mixing limit on those poly strings. And I mean, this whole process is necessary because the mixing limit is so nice because it basically just characterizes a simplex. The convex hull was a simplex, which is easy to understand. But the convex hull of bitwise independent error distributions on this space, where we have different errors are equivalent to each other, it's a lower dimensional space, but you have the same number of external points. And it's some general ugly polytone which you won't be able to characterize. And again, just a remark, it's the simplest case. It can all be generalized. One way to generalize it is to look at different independence constraints. So for example, you can look at CSS type fault tolerance. So this condition here is a very strict notion of fault tolerance. You require errors to be of order p to the weight of that error. Here I'm just saying the probability of an error is upper bounded by either p to the x part of that error or to the z part of that error. So this comes naturally when you're looking at CSS companies. Then I'm saying, or at most p cubed, I don't require any bound strong for the p cubed. That would also be fine. So now, one last point though. I said that standard fault tolerance techniques achieve error satisfying this strict notion of fault tolerance, or the previous one. That's not quite true. So the upper bounds are certainly achievable by standard techniques. But we also need lower bounds. We do need that these errors are theta of p to the weight of x, not just order of that. And it is certainly possible that perhaps that some gates could be much more accurate than others. The ratio between failure rates between gates could be arbitrary. And in that case, we won't have lower bounds on the error rates comparable to the upper bounds. So there's basically two cases. First of all, at the physical level, it may be the case that all gates fail at comparable error rates. It might seem unrealistic that some of the gates will be perfect and other gates will fail at 1%. Perhaps all gates fail at 1% or all gates fail at between 1% and 1.5%. And in that case, standard techniques will achieve this bound with mixing flaps. But at higher levels of concatenation, as we work to analyze the scheme, this won't work out. So the effective gate error model for an encoded gate depends on which elements of the mixture you've chosen for all the previous encoded gates, all the gates at the next level down. And so the error model of this gate depends on what we've been doing. And so what exactly the failure rate of that gate is will be some quadratic function of these other error rates. So the ratios between the largest possible error rate and the lowest possible error rate is going to be diverging doubly exponentially fast in the number of levels. And so, in other words, the upper bound will be fine, but the lower bound could be much, much, much lower. And so the easiest way around this is to deliberately introduce errors by updating with the poly frame. So you don't need to know exactly what the error rate is, you just need to know what the upper bound is. So say I know the upper bound is order 5 p to the weight of x. I introduce errors perhaps at rate 5 p to the x. Now the new upper bound is 10 p to the x, and now the new lower bound is 5 p to the x. So there's now just a ratio of 2. The lower bound and the upper bound are comparable to each other, mixing applies. What does this actually mean for the experimentalist? Well, it means occasionally you'll reject states without any detected errors, because you'll have introduced errors into the poly frame, and you'll see that you've done so, and so you'll reject the state and start over. a little silly, but it's necessary. Also, it will also sometimes happen that one of these areas which you've introduced will cancel out visit layers. So perhaps there is a bit flip error there, and you know it, but you've deliberately introduced a poly bit flip error, and so they cancel out. Yes.
Just a question about this procedure. I mean, do you believe this is just technicality, or is there a fundamental reason that it seems like it's harder? You know, you prove there's a threshold, then you experiment this actually introduces deliberate errors. So it seems likely that there also exists an even better threshold, but he refrains from doing so, although you can't prove this.
Yeah.
But I mean, so I just want to think about this.
Yeah, so I don't think it hurts the threshold very much, because you don't have to introduce errors at very high rates. Perhaps a factor of two or something, perhaps a factor of 10 even, but that's not that significant. But also, in terms of whether a threshold exists without this, I think the Eliphorus guys with Presco would. But the kinds of error correlations I'm worried about, those could occur. And these kinds of correlations do occur if some gates are much better than others.
But somehow there's another way to get rid of it, if they're massive.
Yeah. Isn't just randomizing the public frame under this?
Yes. Sorry.
You just randomize the public frame, isn't it? You get a synchronize. Does it resolve the problem?
Yeah.
So it's fictitious. I mean, you just do it on a piece of paper, you say, I forgot what the poly frame is.
No. So you mean depends. You mean randomizing sense of introducing errors in some of that, or randomizing and keep track of it?
Randomizing in the front.
No, I don't think it does. Because it doesn't kill the existence of correlated errors. It will decorrelate the type of errors, maybe, but not whether or not they are both there.
I mean, so I'm not claiming that the true distribution set has any independence constraints. I'm just claiming that the convolved distribution, the total distribution, does. Or it can be rewritten as a mixture. So that's basically the essence of the proof. That's the main idea. There are a few more problems which need to be solved if you want to actually finish the threshold proof. So first of all, efficiency. A scheme based on error detection, it seems like it should cause exponential overhead. And so one problem is to make the overhead theoretically efficient. The second problem is how we achieve universality. And so this is a particular problem when we're introducing poly errors by changing the poly frame. Because when you're applying universal gates, you might not be able to propagate your changes in the poly frame through the circuit. And so you need some way of achieving universality. And this is done by magic state distillation. So here's a picture of the whole, of one possible scheme. So all I've talked about is what's going on in this portion here. It's with these levels of state factors, each of them running error detection to produce larger and larger states and higher levels of concatenation. The next step is to, eventually you have to switch to an error correction based game. You can't do error detection forever if you want to be efficient. And so the way you switch to an error correction based game is you encode into it, and then you decode out from the bottom up all this stuff down here. And so you have to analyze that. And finally, to get universality, you need to apply magic case distillation, which is, I'm not going to describe that. So eventually, you plug it all together, and it reaches the data. But I think rather than talk about these portions, I'm going to keep on talking about in the last few minutes what's going on up here a little bit more carefully, and then talk about how we get these numerical threshold order bounds. And so this slide has a bunch of information on it. The main idea is that we want to simplify things as much as possible, because it's a rather complicated calculation for a laptop, say, or any computer. And so the techniques involve, we try to reduce it to the simplest possible operation, just it's going to be encoded bell pair preparation. We use the simplest code we can, it'll be a four qubit code. And we enforce symmetries if we can do so. So there are a couple of caveats to these bells. So one silly one is that it's a limited precision arithmetic. So I'm not actually showing that mixing happens, I'm only showing that it happens up to 45 digits of precision, which seems true. A second caveat is that I assume monotonicity constraints. So for these numerical things, I'm going to say that once every single error parameter has decreased, I'm going to claim that I'm below the threshold. And you know, this could be made rigorous. You could say, just repeat the analysis until the error rate's really small, less than some very small number, and then you could then apply some theoretical existence argument. But I think that's a fairly minor caveat. It's a lot of work to fix it up. I guess a third caveat, which isn't here, is that for these bounds, I'm using deep polarizing points. So that's important. It's probably not that important, but it's certainly useful for some of the centralization that I do. And so how does this actually work? Instead of this whole procedure of pulling back the distribution from omega 1 to some space omega 2 and then applying this mixing law and so on, let's just do things by brute force directly. And so we have upper and lower bounds, say we're trying to prepare some state. We have upper and lower bounds for every coordinate of the state. So essentially, we know that the output distribution lies in some axis-aligned prism, rectangle, in some high-dimensional space. And so we just look at this prism. We choose a set of distributions satisfying these independence constraints. We just check, does this prism lie inside their convex hull or not? This is something that can be done by running a linear program. But what you have to do is you have to look at every vertex of this and check individually that each of these vertices lies inside the convex hull. So this is actually, it's fine, but it's quite expensive in higher dimensions. So if you had, say, 64 dimensions, you'd have to check 2 to the 64 vertices. You'd have to do this linear program. Fortunately, there are a lot of tricks which can make these computations quite doable. So the first trick is reduction to bell pair preparation. So how do we apply a control NOT gate? What we do, we're going to teleport into it. So here's a teleportation circuit for one bit. Here's another teleportation circuit. And I apply a control NOT to the output. In other words, from the state, I teleport it to the control NOT gate. So a natural thing to do would be to prepare this state here. If these were the 4-qubit code, it would have 16 qubits, and you'd have to purify that state a few times, and then apply this mixing technique. But you have 16 qubits, that means you're going to have 2 to the 16 inequivalent syndromes. And so you have 2 to the 16 dimensions, and you have 2 to the 2 to the 16 things you have to check, which is left. And so actually, we can do slightly better. So notice that the state up here on the left-hand side is exactly the same as the state here on the right-hand side. So what we do is we prepare not that state, but this one here. So I have two bell pairs and then a control NOT gate from the first to the fourth box. And now, if these two blocks were independent before this gate, they will still be independent. And it's the same here. And in this physical state, the only dependencies will be between the first block and the fourth block. So those dependencies are introduced by the state. And so when we teleport into the circuit, the errors in the output blocks will still be independent of each other. And so by doing this, we've reduced the problem from having to assume that all the bits are across this whole 16-bit state, down to showing that it's enough to show that errors are independent across only an 8-bit state. So the dimensionality is reduced to just 2 to the 8. But again, that's too high of a difference, especially on my laptop. So let's go a little bit further. Here I've written down the 422 code. I've written down the stabilizers for the encoded fault error, which we're trying to prepare. So there's 8 gates. Each of these is a stabilizer generator. These first 4 are the stabilizers for the code. Here, this is logical XX, this is DZ. And we have 2 degrees of freedom because the code encodes 2 qubits into each block, which aren't fixed yet. So if we fix them, then we have 8 independent generators. But if we don't fix them, actually, what we can do is we can deliberately randomize those qubits just by updating that. Just by updating the polyframes with probability in half. So by deliberately randomizing these degrees of freedom, we only have 6 different stabilizers whose syndromes might be tricked. And so the dimensionality is reduced by another factor of 4. To keep on going, we can say this state has lots of permutation symmetries. For example, if we switch the first block with the second block, the first 4 qubits with the second block, with probably 1/2, it'll create exactly the same state, but it will simplify the errors. So by deliberately introducing all these symmetries, which can be done just by relabeling in a non-local model, that reduces the dimensionality down to just 17, which is great. If you assume now, here, if you assume that the noise model is highly symmetric, like it was, this is why I'm using that property, then in fact, you can also symmetrize against the Hadamard gate. So I'm not assuming that you have a perfect Hadamard gate, but you can effectively apply a perfect Hadamard gate. So what you do is, every time you were going to prepare a K+, you prepare a K0. Every time you're applying a control knock gate in this direction, you apply it in the opposite direction. Because the noise model, I'm assuming, is symmetric, that state is exactly the same as if I apply a perfect transversal hadamard. So symmetrizing also against permutations and hadamards just leaves 11 different equivalent kinds of errors. And this is quite reasonable to do for brute force mixing analysis. And that's probably enough to give you a good flavor of how this stuff works. This really works just at the first level of concatenation. It gives you very good balance for the first level. At higher levels, you can't enforce symmetrization for certain technical reasons. And so at higher dimensions, I have to revert back to the mixing level, which is slightly more inefficient than this tight brute force analysis. Because it's happening only at the second level of the coding, the inefficiencies at the first level aren't so bad when you pull it back. I think basically at the second level, you're losing perhaps a factor of 10 to 100, perhaps a couple orders of magnitude. And so at the first level, if you take the square root of that, it's not so terrible. And let me just finish. Again, these are the results.
Questions? So in our paper, we didn't use the polarizing channel. We had a general, more general channel, but not completely general adversarial channel. We had these local adversaries. But I'm wondering if by adding noise in the way you do, maybe we could go back to the more general adversarial count. I don't know if you have thought about anything related to this.
Whether you could do that.
Well,
from your shell group.
No, let me put it this way. We can show that for the general
adversarial channel, it doesn't work. I mean, there is an adversary that can defeat it using post-selection. So the question is, does that argument still hold true if you're adding points?
I see.
I'm kind of curious if you thought about combining these error detection codes with higher level correction codes. So, in other words, you have this lower level state preparation going on, but then you could imagine that at the higher level, knowing where the error is, that can correct it. That's potentially higher efficiency, assuming the error is right. So, at the higher level, small.
Yes, so I didn't really explain. Camille Steen very, very much, but he in fact does do things like this. So, in fact, the way Steen works is he uses error detection only at the highest levels, not at the lower levels. So once you get yourself up to a level K block, you only do error detection at the highest level, and you use error detection at lower levels.
Okay. So you're already using this.
But
so you're using that.
I'm not using that in my proof of the existence, nor in these numerical lower bounds, but he does in his, because he also analyzes the overhead, and so certainly things like this are quite important. All right. Yeah.
Any questions?